Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Welcome to Banking Weekly from the Financial Times with me, Patrick Jenkins. Joining me in the studio is the FT's retail banking correspondent, Charlene Goff, and Danielle Schaefer, investment banking correspondent. On the line, we have Miles Johnson from Madrid to talk about Spain. That's the clue that the first topic this week we'll be looking at is a look at the ongoing Eurozone crisis, particularly as it's manifesting itself in Spain. But also, we'll look at what's going on in Greece.
By having to nationalise banking, an institution which the bank itself and successive governments have said is completely stable and would not need any more state aid, has sort of exploded that myth.
We'll discuss the impact of the CIO loss at JP Morgan. This is the specialist treasury operation at JP Morgan that lost $2 billion. It was revealed last week.
I think that the potential damage is really huge. You know, it goes way beyond the $2 billion losses.
And finally, we'll look at Canary Wharf, London's new financial centre that is only 20 years old, which is set to overtake the City of London as the biggest employer of bankers in Europe in the next couple of months.
It's quite remarkable to have a complete new centre of power for the banks being built up within just two decades.
Firstly, the Eurozone and the crisis there, which shows no signs of abating. Miles, last week was a pretty tumultuous one for the Spanish banks, not least Bankia, the kind of merged entity created out of seven cajas a year or so ago and then floated. What did you think was the most dramatic development last week in terms of that Spanish banking story?
Well, I think last week, obviously, there was a sort of high degree of drama with one of the largest banks in the country being part nationalized. But I think the most important thing from last week was the moment in the banking crisis so far where the government could no longer deny the true extent of the problem, in the sense that Bankia is almost symbolic of the banking reforms which Spain has tried to push through so far, which have been sort of piecemeal and sort of incremental, really solved the problem which is at the heart of Spanish banks. And I think by having to nationalize banking, an institution which the bank itself and successive governments have said is completely stable and would not need any more state aid, has sort of exploded that myth.
And what about that kind of broader question of the kind of health of the broader property loans that the sector is exposed to? As you say, the kind of new requirement on provisioning is kind of yet another step by the authorities to try and shore up the defences of the banks. But there's some question as to whether that's even enough, even, you know, after that's been done, whether that will be enough. We had, you make the comparisons with the Irish crisis, actually the losses that were experienced on the property loans there were higher than even these topped-up provisions.
Well, yes, this is really the problem because, you know, as you know, I've been speaking to analysts who now tell me, you know, no number which comes out of Spanish banks or the central bank is really taken seriously by anyone anymore, because there is this sort of credibility problem now. Because if you turn around and you say, we have now implemented a definitive banking reform as the previous government did, and then you have to bail out the bank, you know, 6 months, 8 months down the line, no one will believe your numbers anymore. And the real problem here is that saying you will raise more provisions against bad property assets is one thing, but do people really care if this is going to be 20 billion, 30 billion, 40 billion? I don't really think so. I think the most important step, which we saw from the reform last Friday, was that Spain is going to bring in independent auditors to, for the first time, look at banks' books and give an independent opinion, which should hopefully reassure international observers and investors that these numbers are credible.
You've identified that there are a few parties that they are already talking to, although no one's yet been appointed, is that right?
Well, as I understand it, the Bank of Spain invited certain advisors last month to come in to the Bank of Spain and draw up some proposals around the idea of this bad bank, although they were very keen not to call it a bad bank, actually due to the experiences of Ireland, where, you know, Nama eventually didn't go entirely to the plans of some of its designers. But there are, you know, BlackRock Solutions, which was one of the parties which was involved in the Irish situation, was there, and a couple of others. But the mandates for that, I don't think, have been decided yet. What we will see. I mean, this really is an extremely important step, and maybe the last time a Spanish government will have its fate in its own hands in regards to the country's banks.
An attempt to restore credibility on the quantity of the this problem. But what happens then once that once a credible number is out there? There are quite a few people who think, including myself actually, who thinks that the only way that Spain can probably get out of this is to resort to European bailout money if they can get hold of it. Is that, do you think, becoming a consensus view?
It is becoming closer to a consensus view among sort of analysts and maybe observers outside of the country, but among politicians here, it really is Rubicon, which remains, you know, very far from being crossed. I think no one wants to have any external interference in the banks. And I think just the pure stigma of seeking external money is just something which politicians would not be able to stomach at the moment. Whether they'll be forced into that position is another matter, because simply put, the government does not have the money to be throwing into banks. I mean, it's quite important that the state aid offered to banks on Friday was in the forms of loans, high interest loans.
But surely that's the problem, is that it's not credible enough to restore confidence, that if it's in that form of loans, it's not. That's not what the sector needs, really. It needs equity, and equity isn't available.
Exactly. I mean, this really is the problem. I mean, Luis de Guindos, the Spanish finance minister, said that state aid, he did not expect it to be more than 15 billion. This is 15 billion in a problem which, you know, is a 300 billion plus loan book.
So finally, Miles, what should we expect this week and over the coming weeks in terms of the Spanish authorities' response to the banking crisis?
Well, I think we've already seen today, at the start of the week, we've seen banks coming out and explaining to their investors how they're going to raise this money. So far, every bank seems to say that they're going to raise the money from their own retained earnings and they're not going to have to resort to state aid. What we will soon see is whether their investors believe them. And I think, you know, bank shares in Spain are down sharply today. And there is a sort of feeling that some of the banks are going to have to raise capital. And secondly, you know, we have an interesting sort of secondary effect on Spanish business, which is that a lot of these banks, at least the savings banks, the cajas, they have industrial holdings. For example, Bankia has 12% of IAG, you know, which contains British Airways and Iberia. And these are likely to be sold or in some form. Whether we're going to see that immediately is not clear, but
that's a very good point. This could really lead to a shake-up of ownership of corporate Spain.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, listen, on that note, thank you very much, Miles. Charlene, Spain's banks are not just restricted to activity in Spain. We've got Spain's biggest bank, Santander, has a substantial operation in the UK. Should customers of that bank, Santander UK, be concerned at all about the ramifications of the Spanish crisis?
Well, Santander would, I'm pretty sure, say no, because they've been pretty clear, especially recently, that their subsidiary model means each geographical business has its own protection, its own capital, and, you know, that can't be sort of drained by problems in the group in Madrid. But, you know, I mean, they're a Spanish bank. I guess it's always going to be of some concern. And Santander have been one of the first banks to come out and say how they expect to meet the new provision levels. They've got to raise a further sort of almost 3 billion euros, but they think they can do it. And, you know, their track record of raising fresh capital has been pretty good, almost surprisingly good at times. They've managed to meet prior requirements extremely quickly.
Well, at the end of last year, they came up through a variety of transactions with about 15 billion, didn't they?
Yeah.
Within a matter of weeks, exactly, in order to meet the requirements of the European Banking Authority.
Yeah, and they always say they can sell bits and pieces of their international business. I think they're now looking to fund some of this capital by the sale of its Colombian unit and also retained earnings. I mean, how long they can keep dipping into retained earnings remains to be seen. But, you know, at the moment, I think there isn't dire worries about the bigger banks.
No, as you say, Santander and BBVA are, you know, pretty robust. They've got a lot of their income coming from overseas. And I think if Bankia had a UK subsidiary, we might be justly concerned about the solidity of that. Of course, Spain isn't the only hotspot in the Eurozone crisis at the moment. Greece is very much a focus as well. This week, we are seeing the Eurozone's finance ministers meeting to discuss the issue. What do you think is going to be their kind of starting point of discussion?
Well, they haven't had much joy in Greece over the weekend. I think there's been a whole series of meetings that were eventually abandoned. They couldn't form a government again. And, you know, there seems that they won't be able to do that. I think we're heading for fresh elections there next month. That seems the most likely scenario. And as all that happens, I think people are slowly warming up to the idea that, you know, a Greek exit from the euro is not unthinkable anymore. I mean, even a year ago, people were saying, look, this, you know, this would be a disaster. This can't happen. Now, increasingly, people still think this is unlikely. But they're thinking, you know, we have to prepare. And some very senior sort of officials in Europe are being franker than they have been and saying that, you know, they are thinking this is a possible scenario and we have to think about it and we have to make preparations. And indeed, that's happening now more than it has ever before.
And obviously, this is all this uncertainty is pretty bad news for the Greek banks. We don't have any data on the departure of deposits from the Greek banking system in the last week or so since the election. But I can't imagine that it's a particularly stable deposit base. That obviously makes things difficult for them. But it's the knock-on effect for banks abroad as well,
exactly,
that most people are concerned.
It's not just Greece. And I'm sure there has been, you know, a big outflow of deposits into safer, perceived safer areas, you know, the German banks, for example, but likewise in Portugal and Spain and Ireland again. You know, that seems to have weathered things quite well. But, you know, this growing sort of talk of a Greek exit would definitely shine the spotlight back on those areas. And that's the big fear. You know, that's why people really don't want it to happen, the fear of contagion. And there are some optimists out there who think that could be limited, and if you can convince the markets that, you know, it was a decision by Greece, they weren't forced out, you know, that would probably be the way people are thinking it would happen.
Yes.
And so, you know, maybe the contagion could be limited, but I think that isn't probably an over-optimistic scenario.
Yeah, quite. We should move on to our second topic, JP Morgan. Now, Daniel, you were watching this very closely last week when, to everyone's surprise, Jamie Dimon, the chief executive, came out and admitted that his pretty flawless track record over the past few years since the financial crisis hit had been rather sullied by a surprise $2 billion trading loss. Interesting where it came. Basically, this operation, which is their treasury business, in other words, their own funds, some people might see this as a giant proprietary trading operation. Were you surprised to see this loss?
Yes, it was very surprising, although it came with a short warning, because in early April, there were first reports suggesting that there's been a in this unit, which frankly, not many people really outside of the banking industry knew, or not many analysts were watching closely before that happened, that one trader in London, Bruno Ixel, a French-born banker who's been dubbed as the London Whale because he made such a big trade that it became such a big position. Some say it's up to 100 billion on one specific credit derivative or credit default swap index, that there are these reports that it has become so big that it's difficult to unwind. And at the time, in the middle of April, Jamie Dimon said, this is a tempest in a teapot. There's nothing going on. It's all wrong, the reports, basically. And he said this week, last week, he firstly had to admit there's now a $2 billion loss. It came out of the blue, basically. And this week, at the end of last week, he admitted that he was dead wrong in calling it a tempest in a teapot. So he was very quick to say, I got that wrong, and there's something really, you know, really big going on, and he admitted to it. The question is, how much did he know before about this, what's going on there? And the other question is, obviously, I mean, how could a bank, JP Morgan, known for its risk management, for its really, you know, being basically at the forefront of good risk management, how could a bank like that let that happen?
How much damage do you think has been done to JP Morgan's reputation, Jamie Dimon's reputation, and I think, finally, the other area that people are concerned about, of obviously, is banks' ability to continue to lobby against tighter regulation, given that Mr. Dimon was at the forefront of that kind of anti-regulatory drive. And this is an area, this derivatives area, is one that's kind of escaped the toughest of regulation thus far. And this is obviously going to harden the resolve of reformers to clamp down, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that the potential damage is really huge. You know, it goes way beyond the 2 billion losses. And, you know, maybe it's going to be more losses, even more losses than that. We don't know. But it's going to go way beyond that. For one thing, J.P. Morgan and Jamie Dimon in particular, he was strongly arguing against the Volcker rule in the US, which basically prohibits banks from trading with their own money and speculating with their own money. And so it's going to be really difficult now for him to argue against it when basically JP Morgan has, what some say, you know, turned the Treasury into a sort of proprietary trading desk. I mean, they're disputing that, but people outside the banks, this is actually what has happened. And the other thing is, it's going to bring discussions about derivatives and credit default swaps back on the agenda. JP Morgan is one of the biggest players in that space. So, you know, so that I think there's going to be more regulatory backlash on that. And on the third level, JP Morgan is the biggest bank in the US, and it's got a $2.3 trillion balance sheet. And people are starting to wonder, is this bank too big to control all the risk it's got? So it's going to bring, in other words, it's going to bring the discussion back on the agenda about
too big to fail. So, Charlene, do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think this will bring, again, fresh questions on regulators, like why it's taken them so long to, you know, get a new system in place. It's not just JP Morgan, it's all the banks, you know, again, come under the spotlight. I mean, we saw share price falls across the board on Friday, and I'm sure we will again today.
Yeah, I suppose the counter argument is that as long as the bank is strong enough to withstand losses like this, it kind of should be up to a bank to take the kind of level of risk that it wants to, as long as it's not going to pose a problem. And as we've reported, obviously JP generates in a quarter way more than the losses on this transaction, as far as we're aware, they amount to at the moment. So
I mean, that's the interesting thing about it as well. I mean, everybody's pointing now to this $2 billion loss, but actually, I mean, the chief investment office in the past few years has generated a lot of profits as well that go I think way beyond the $2 billion that they've come out with a loss now. So you know, unless it turns into something really big in terms of the losses, it is sort of a tempest in a teapot if you just look at it from a pure economic perspective for JP Morgan. But obviously, the political and public debate is just going to look at the $2 billion.
Exactly. Our final topic for today is about London's financial centre. And again, Daniel, JP Morgan is at the centre of it, actually. As we reported in Monday's paper, the kind of centre of gravity of London as a financial centre is shifting, thanks to JP Morgan's shifting of its European headquarters from the city to Canary Wharf, which is taking place gradually and will be completed by July. It's about 8,000 bankers in total moving across. And by our calculations, that means there's going to be more than 44,000 people working at the big banks in Canary Wharf, 1,000 or so more than in the city at the big banks. Is this a big, significant day, do you think? Or does it not matter at all?
I think it does matter in the sense that, firstly, for some of the bankers who work in Canary Wharf, they don't really like Canary Wharf. And so it will matter for the 8,000 people at JP Morgan. Most of whom, I think, will say, I'd like more working in the city than I do in Canary Wharf. Canary Wharf is seen as very sterile and not, you know, it's been built from scratch, basically. It's all modern and nice, but it doesn't have this old feeling and nice, you know, feeling that the city has, as you know. So most bankers we speak to, they enjoy working in the city if they work in the city. Most others who work in Canary Wharf say it's okay, but it's not it's not like working in the city.
No, quite.
And it does matter, as you know, it's quite remarkable to have a complete new center of power for the banks being built up within just two decades.
Yeah, exactly. It's about 20 years, almost exactly, since Canary Wharf sprang up. It's taken some time to get the momentum, but Charlene, do you think it's going to continue?
I think it will. I mean, we have got a number of skyscrapers going up around the city area. I mean, it's interesting what it would mean for them, you know, if they're going to have trouble filling that room. And I think it's also interesting from the sort of cultural perspective. And there were a couple of quotes in the piece you mentioned on Monday's paper just saying how, you know, sort of comparing it to a bit of a beehive. You know, I thought that was really interesting, saying that, you know, bankers need to get out and actually interact with each other. And, you know, in Canary Wharf, they tend to be very enclosed in their huge tower blocks.
That's one of the criticisms that you hear about management, kind of executive floors at these big banks. They're up on, you know, the 30th or the 40th floor. And in some cases, that encourages them to stay there and never interact.
So you lose that whole, you know, the whole sort of traditions of the city and the kind of, you know, the not seedy, but, you know, the pubs and the... Yeah. And that's
client,
a shame, I think.
The client relationship issue is one that we kind of alluded to in the piece. And I think it's one that a lot of bankers feel very strongly, that both from, you know, pleasantness of working existence point of view, but also from a real practical kind of client interaction point of view, being stuck out in Canary Wharf, a place that clients don't necessarily want to go to, is not necessarily a sustainable one. And in many cases, as for example at JP Morgan, they're maintaining a presence in the city in order to be able to meet their clients, which is slightly defeating the object, you'd have thought. Sadly, we need to finish there. That's it for this week. All that's left for me to do is to thank Charlene and Daniel, and also to thank Miles on the line, and to thank you for listening. Remember that you can keep up to date with all of the latest banking stories at ft.com/banking. Banking Weekly was produced by Katie Carney. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of The Next Five podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next Five wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.